The title of this session is Elie Wiesel, Night and the Holocaust, which we are not even going to dream of covering in the short time that we have. I need to know how many of you have read Night at some point in your life. Okay, pretty good, so we can have some discussion of that. I think that we're also, though, going to just try to talk about some of the, well, if you will, the framework for the Holocaust. It was, how many have been to the Holocaust Museum yet? Any? It's very moving, isn't it?
Living in Washington, D.C.?
Yes,
I'm thinking of Israel.
And you've seen that, too? Long ago I wrote this. I read about the concentration camp and wept, "Dear God, it is not gratitude to count my blessings, feeling proud of the list and overfed today. Nay, thanksgiving comes from the awareness of the existence of evil, the presence of death, the weakness of humans, including me, and the redeeming chance to share because I'm given one more hour to live." Elie Wiesel, as you probably know, was 15 when he lived in Sziget, which was in a small little village in Hungary. And the whole town was cleared out and sent to Auschwitz, where his sister and mother disappeared that first night. And he and his father lived for some months afterwards. And Night is that story. It's obviously a short book. And it's written, he made a vow after he had escaped, well, hardly escaped, after he was freed, that he would not write anything for 10 years because he wanted to be sure that he had perspective before he wrote. And this was that book. Were probably written in French because he lived in Paris. Then he became a correspondent, a newspaper correspondent. My connection with Elie Wiesel began in, well, before that, but for sure in 1991. I knew that I would be going to Cambridge to study at Harvard for the fall. And so with all the audacity of anyone I can think of, I wrote to him and asked if I could talk with him. He was going to be teaching classes at Boston University, where he still does teach some. And I had an idea for a book I wanted to do, but I just could not get off the dime. And so I thought, I knew that if I saw Elie Wiesel, I'd be able to write that book. And he was so gracious as to say, yes, that would be fine, I could meet with him. And he is gracious from head to toe. A small person. Yeah, in comparison to me, a lot smaller than I am, for example. Infinitely kind, marvelous listener, introvert, who loves his books. And it was true. We talked briefly that day. He was very busy. And by the time I left there, I knew I would be able to write that book. And he said, just write it. Just write it. Don't think about it. Just let it come. And I said, but I'm thinking of writing poetry. That's all right. Just write it, he said. So he was, for me, an empowering individual. And that changes, of course, how I view all that I talk about. The story of Night brings for us to the foreground some of the great issues that we experience in regard to the Holocaust. What would be some of those questions, do you suppose, that come to the minds of many and the hearts of many when we think about the Holocaust? It's right in the front of the story, and it's sustained throughout. And it goes on after this. Never again. I will never believe again. Now, he was a Hasidic Jew, he had studied as a young man. He just loved learning and loved the faith. So this was so traumatic at his young age, and it lasted for considerable time. Now his books, I want to tell you about another tape, and I think this is really worth checking on. This is in here in our tape library. It's Robert McAfee Brown, who also knows Wiesel. You know, and I think the title of it is just Elie Wiesel. And what he does is, I just listened to it, he takes Wiesel's books and begins, at least some of them. He's written about 30 now, 35 books, and so we can't keep track of them all, you know. But he took some of those early books and reviewed them, the first one being Night, and the second one, do you know the second one? Was called Dawn. And the third one in English is called The Accident. And the fourth one, which I'm very fond of, is called The Town Beyond the Wall. And there's a long list, but one of my favorites also is One Generation After, 25 years later. He goes back, literally, and reflects in short pieces, usually. Some are sort of a dramatic dialogue, and some are short stories and reflections on what he has been learning. And I later read a book called The Jew Today, which I found very interesting because his personality is very different in that book. And it's more expository, it's more essayish than the others, where the others have all been novels. In each of those, pardon?
What was the name of that?
I know what it is. I've got it. A Jew Today.
A Jew Today.
Uh-huh. And you can trace his faith journey in the books. And what he's doing often is posing the different ways one could comprehend and participate in and understand the Holocaust and how it might affect, for example, different victims in different ways. Dawn is clearly one way of somebody coping with what had happened. And each of them is slightly different, so is The Accident. So McAfee Brown talks about those, and I recommend his tape. I'm looking for that list. Here it is. And I also appreciated I can't find it. At any rate, he also discusses the oath, which is another way to approach what had happened. Well, we won't go on with that. At any rate, that's in the tape. So now, here are these enormous philosophical questions we have. Can you read them? About this experience. Why don't you pass these about? These are the maps of the concentration camps. It's probably not quite enough for everyone. Maybe if you could share every other. And I'll get them back from you. And while you're doing that, tell me what you think the word Holocaust means.
With a small H?
Sure.
Okay.
With a small H, yeah.
It's something like obliteration, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have anything more to add to that? It's funny how we don't know a word, in a way, isn't it? I mean, I used it for years before I ever looked it up.
I've been to three or four of the drug camps, and whenever I hear the word, I just see fire. Just
you see?
A fire.
That's exactly what it means. It's destruction and obliteration by fire.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So at one point, he begins to talk about the future and saying, we still could do this. This would not necessarily be Christian against Jew. This could be Christian against Christian, anybody against anybody, and we would obliterate the world through nuclear holocaust.
I was just going to say one of the questions that I thought about when I was reading the book that I don't think he deals with is how can God let his name be used against people? Because the Nazis were masters of I can't think what they had, and their belt buckles and
God is with us.
You just kind of go, well, wait a minute. How can that be?
One of the things that Brown reminds us is that Wiesel has less problem with Christ, Jesus, and more problem with how Christians have used Jesus. Which we can take to heart then. So a Holocaust is obliteration by fire. Now, how do you react to this map that you just have seen?
I didn't realize there were that many. I knew quite a few, but I didn't realize there were that many camps or that many extermination.
I remember meeting a woman who lived outside Treblinka, which is a fairly large lettered one in Poland. And we asked, do you think people knew? She said you could smell it all over town. So that whole sense of not wanting to know and not letting ourselves know. Do we still do that today?
Yeah, sure. In Cambodia, between two of the Transcaucasus, Azerbaijan and the other one, the Turks did it in Bosnia.
So it goes on. So looking the other way is not an old thing.
Which one checks that?
Mm-hmm. And in Russia. Yeah. So we are not dealing only with something that's 50 years old, although this is the 50th anniversary of the liberation of the camps. This is something that trails us and does ask us this question about inhumanity among people. Now, we see how Lizelle in Night does not resolve where God was at all, does he? Where do you think God was? I mean, was this some part of some great, I tell you, some great, magnificent plan?
Page 62 has an interesting answer. Where is God now? And I heard a voice within me answer him. Where is he? Here he is. He is hanging here on this gallows.
To give you background for those who haven't read it, one of the things they were all required to observe was the hanging of some of the other prison maids. And in this case, it was a very young boy. And it took him a very long time to die because it just didn't work. He was lightweight. And so everyone was forced to watch that. And that's when someone from behind Rizal said, where is he? You know, where is God now? This person was furious, of course. And then here he is hanging on the gallows. Now for us, what does that image call up? Death of Christ. But our view of Christ, you see, has always got that other side to it, which contains that love of Jesus and the death for our sake. And for someone who is not, for whom that has no meaning, perhaps, or doesn't connect, what does this look like?
God is dead.
God is dead. This is total despair. Talk a little about the quality and the quantity of life. I think Mary said you
did that. I remember during war in Vietnam, people talking about cages that were put underground. In fact, one of our people was a congressman, a senator, was in prison for almost 5 years. And I thought, I would give up. I wouldn't endure. I see no point in enduring something like that because quality means more time. But in this book, it gets surreal at the end where he can hardly distinguish night and day and hunger and thirst. And I think, what spark of courage, what ultimate spark of courage or something was it that sustained him?
Now, I have a tape here, and if any of you do want to watch it, it's called Facing Hate. And it's Wiesel, and he's being interviewed by Bill Moyers. And it's about an hour long, which is why I couldn't really use it. Typically, I use it interspersed with other things. And in it, he talks about why some lived and some didn't. And he would not respond to the notion that a spark of life somehow, or that will to live, is what helped you survive. He says it was pure random luck. If this whole group of people is in front of you and they just at will just point to these people and those are the ones who live and the rest die, you don't know, which is part of why it was so terrorizing. There was no apparent reason for anything. It didn't make sense. It never made sense. So what works for us in terms of, you know, hanging on to hope, it wasn't working in the camp. It couldn't work because it was so random and so painful. Let me read you something that one of our great benefactors wrote. This is by Luther. Luther started out in defensive of and concerned for Jews and spoke in terms of Jesus being a Jew, and this made a lot of sense. But he changed somewhere along the line. You know, he was a weird guy sometimes. And so when this was one of his personality changes here, and what he said was, and of course this is now what is being read in the German schools and churches, first set fire to their synagogues or schools and to bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. Now that's just too prophetic to deny. Are we capable of this inhumanity among people? Indeed, we are. Second, I advise that their houses be razed and destroyed, for they pursue in them the same aims as in their synagogues. And instead, they might be lodged under a roof or in a barn like the gypsies. This will bring home to them the fact that they are not the masters in our country, as they boast, but they are living in exile and captivity. For him to use all his biblical images is amazing to me. As they incessantly wail and lament about us before God. Third, I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings, in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught, be taken from them. Now, when did we see that? Kristallnacht, huh? When all the books were burned. Fourth, I advise their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on the pain of loss and life, of life and limb. And he used Deuteronomic background there. Fifth, safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews. Let them stay at home. These are longer, but I'm just making them brief. And sixth, I advise that usury be prohibited to them. And put aside for safekeeping. Usury was a kind of a big deal in the Middle Ages. I mean, that was the... And you know what usury is?
Money.
It's what we do all the time. It's credit. You know, it's loans. It's borrowing money and taking interest, which we all do all the time. But it fell into disrepute for some people in the Middle Ages. So sadly, you see, our own tradition in terms of the Holocaust, it's not a positive one, is it?
Could you just explain, I don't know the explanation, of why Luther would feel that way about the Jews?
I can give you this paper to read the whole thing. He made it was a clear shift.
Why this happened.
Yeah, and I can't tell you right now. But it may be revealed in here. I've underlined all these things. But I think that also, you remember he made a big shift in terms of the poor and the peasants, whom he had supported at one time, then all of a sudden turned and wanted to squash them all. So it's sort of hard to know why he did these things. But we have to come to terms with the fact that we're part of that in a sense then, that has been passed on down to us. Now the ELCA has recently issued a statement of apology and of doctrine if you will, that says, this is no longer who we are and what we believe. And this was all an error. And it just renounces all of the anti-Semitic behavior and words of the past. It'll take a long time, of course, to bring that along, to come to terms with that. But that helps set the stage for what happened. So when we talk about our inhumanity among people, it is sometimes just the beginning of those ideas and in our leaders. And whether we take them and don't call into question things, we can become part of that same sort of thing. What do you know about where we were during this period of time? As
I know that when Roosevelt was president, that there was a large ship with Jewish refugees that I think put into either Georgia or Florida looking for a place for refuge, and he rejected them, so he must have known something.
Something back, mm-hmm. That's right.
And there were advisors that were telling him, and there were articles in the paper at the time that were starting to share what was happening.
And so we had people advising Roosevelt. He seemed to know some information. And when it was El Talks on this tape that I'm telling you about, that's when his anger shows the most. Because there were moments that he can trace, that he personally can trace, where he knows things could have been different. And the camps could have been liberated before the Russians. They waited until the Russians came through before they liberated the camps. That could have been moved up considerably. On the other hand, we had in this country people like Charles Lindbergh, who we thought of as just this wonderful man, who was absolutely, flagrantly pro-Nazi, shall we say. So everything wasn't always as clear as it looks to us from this point of view, from where we are now. So we always have to ask, don't we, now what would I have done? Would I have stood up and done anything? I'll be talking about Dorothy Day on Saturday. And Dorothy Day was a woman who was a pacifist in World War II. I think that takes an amazing amount of courage. Whether you agree with her or not, just to even do it. Now, would we have done anything? I know what I was watching. I was watching Bugs Bunny cartoons all about how great it was to go to the war. I thought my dad ought to be a soldier. That would be a terrific thing. He didn't like the idea himself. So we can fall victim, especially if we don't talk.
Yeah. I think in that Oklahoma City bombing, it was interesting that it was almost immediate. It had to be a Middle Eastern person.
Yep. And NPR did it.
He was arrested on the plane because he was. And boy, the Americans were ready to come down and deal with the Middle East.
Did you all notice that? That immediate blaming of the Middle Eastern person for this bombing in Oklahoma City? It was scary. When I was listening to NPR, the man who called in was a Jew, and he said, "You can't do this. This is wrong to be making this assumption about Arabs or whatever, whoever they were," which I greatly respected. Let's see now, what was I going to do next?
But I think more than just the society, I mean, the media drove that just as much as the population. I mean, drawing the media ties to the World Trade Center in New York bombing, which was, you know, Middle Eastern bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So we are led around by what we read and see as much as anything else.
And it's hard to sort of always be distinguishing, isn't it? When there are so many parts of the world. We understand ourselves that way, but we also understand that that is, in fact, our weakness.
Anyway, I think if I can play devil's advocate a little bit,
sure.
If we can go back in the Holocaust to 1942, 1941, somewhere in there, as a people, in America, we didn't have instant satellite bombed video of what was happening. We didn't have the films that all of us have seen about the Holocaust and the war and all that. We didn't have any of that knowledge. All we had were some second and third and fourth hand reports and some smuggled photographs coming out of of Germany saying these awful things were happening. But those were being smuggled out by people who we already didn't trust, the Jews.
That's a very important ingredient.
If we can somehow step back and remove everything else that we know about what we know about the Holocaust, it's easy to see why nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy to see.
And that's where Wiesel gets very angry with our leadership.
Right.
Yeah. Although I think your key statement here too was, we didn't, the photographs that were being smuggled out were being smuggled out by people that we didn't already trust.
Oh, we didn't trust, right.
And they were Jews. So we had our own problem.
We weren't quite sure what that was. We were trying to find out what, why they would be, this propaganda was coming out of this area. We didn't understand.
One of the things that really scares me is that that's always just right under the surface. I remember writing an article for the Lutheran about anti-Semitism, and this was in about 1970, and they sent it back and said, well, this doesn't apply anymore. And I thought, whoa. See, but it was because it wasn't on the surface. What is the direction we could be moving now? Which group could we be moving soon against, I think, in this country? Well, who did we take on in the Second World War? Who was it that we oppressed?
The Japanese
in particular, with the camps. And I think Germans were paying a price too, some Germans.
Well, there are all kinds of bills in the Congress about legal immigration, and probably some of them.
The whole immigration thing is up for grabs.
It's a reaction to the illegal immigration problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to be, I think the growth of Muslim Islam in this country is going to, I think people will subtly begin to make their distinctions about the differences being more important than the similarities or than the community.
Last year, France had a huge thing about whether the girls could cover their head in school, and they eventually forbid them to. In Europe, in Spain and France, it's...
Last month in the United States, too.
Mm-hmm. Northwest Airlines.
Right, where someone wasn't allowed to wear whatever the shawl is called, the Islamic head covering.
Yeah, the claim, I mean, the airlines won out, but they had removed her from the plane because she wasn't properly dressed. I would like us to put some theological language into the discussion, just because that's what you always get at church. What's the word for what's the thing we're begging here? Is there any meaning? Is there any meaning in
was God acting within the what happened?
Okay.
Or did God desert?
How do we understand God? Is God powerful, all omnipotent? That's why people like the book, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Because it raises that question. Well, what kind of God is this? Capricious God. And Ellie will come out and say, no, God is not capricious, that we will have to be in dialogue with God regardless, but I'll get to that in a minute. So what is God like? What's our definition of God? And where is God, or what is the meaning of God in the midst of what?
Suffering.
How do we handle suffering? What's the basic question that we're asking about inhumanity among people?
I think what she brought up, are we still capable? Ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And could I have been the executioner? Which is the theme of one of those books. Dawn, I think. It is Dawn.
Is there any meaning? I guess it's also the nature of existence. Is something like this proof that life is meaningless and random and without direction?
Mm-hmm. And Wiesel will come out of that okay. We'll get to that. What about this thing about where were we and could I have been the executionist or the participant and the inhumanity among people?
Yes, and looking at how we treat each other, we treat anybody.
Yeah.
How we treat them in the grocery store, the mall, the wherever. How do we treat them? How do we treat people on the street? How do we treat and
how do we treat gay and lesbian people? How do we treat anybody who seems different, whatever that means, from who we are?
So I guess the question is, yes, it could happen to us. We could.
We could do it. Does that mean, no, the question of evil is probably the question that has come out of this experience the most. Rank evil in the world that is just blatant in front of our eyes. But we don't like to talk about evil very much. Why?
Do we really believe there's an entity such as the devil?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you think there's a devil? What is this about, this devil stuff? The notion of the devil, I mean, the image of the devil that we've developed came also from the Middle Ages, when suddenly you had this being with horns and a tail. And it's entirely different from Satan, who is often kind of the antagonist for God. In the Old Testament, particularly, you see Satan being the prosecuting attorney, I guess, in Job, and saying, all right, God, if it's so great, why don't you just take everything away from Job and see what he does? See if he's really faithful to you then. That kind of position that Satan had is different than the image that we have of the devil. Which, how many of you have basically rejected the image of the devil? Yeah. It's an image. It's just a picture. Yeah, it's just a picture. But do you believe there's evil?
Yes.
I'm encouraged.
The New York Times magazine just had a issue, and I have the article with me. I gave it to Ingrid Christian. And it's about the uprising interest in evil, and it goes through all the stories in the news, from the drowning of the two little boys by their mother to Oklahoma City, and just saying how people are starting to be ready to think about, oh, the two sons, the men, and goes through, and there really aren't any answers in the article, but it talks about why people are taking another look at evil. People who aren't religious people, who aren't just kind of the general culture, is starting to, and I think the international things, Bosnia, the Rwanda, Liberia, whatever. And it's just kind of interesting that we may be in a different time, where I think for a long time there's been a lot of kind of, not in the scientific age, kind of a denial of evil as a real entity.
We thought we could make everything rational and visual.
Yeah.
Paul?
I mean, I believe in evil and Satan, but I think to vote it much for this is kind of a cop-out. A lot of this happened because the people had lust for power, peer pressure, fear of what others would say to them. Evil may have played a little part, but it was people's fallen nature that played a awful lot larger part.
I didn't hear the last sentence.
People's fallen nature, or whatever you want to call it.
Oh. Sin.
The bad side that had a lot more to do with it than Satan.
Sin.
Can you say the devil made me do it? I think that's a problem.
That's where we have to talk about the nature of evil a little bit here, probably. Because the danger with talking about evil is that we can focus it on particular persons or particular events and remove ourselves from it. So the Nazis become the evil in the world, or Hitler becomes the evil person, and then we don't have to take any responsibility. We don't have to buy into the fact that we too sin and fall short and that these things are connected.
But then also it depends on how you define evil, because there are people who talk about evil as kind of a mechanized, bureaucratic thing, not a devilish, satanic thing. That evil, we can redefine evil to something where a process becomes, because Hitler was not, I mean, in lots of ways, he was, you can't make him into a devil, he was sort of inept in a lot of ways, a bureaucratic person too, you know, he was sort of, you know, some of the evil of the Holocaust was almost of the bureaucracy and of the people played their parts without question and...
Or out of fear.
And it just, there was something on public radio about this, about talking about the person who kept the train schedule. That there were all these people that had to be part of it, who had to ignore what was happening. From the person who kept the train schedule and knew these trains were going by with people in them, and talked about evil as bureaucracy. Totally unquestioning bureaucracy. The people continued to do their roles, and that was the nature of evil.
And that is the nature of evil.
Yeah.
Phil, you look just like you want to say something.
I leave it to the Germans to bureaucratize evil. That's all.
Well, Ronald Reagan called Russia the evil empire. I think that's within all many, many governments. If they want to rally their people behind them, they focus on an evil empire. I mean, did he ever talk about the ingrained exploitation of a free society, of a capitalist system? No. But communism, whether he understood what it meant comprehensively or not.
The thing, but I hear us doing something. If we talk about love, we don't need to somehow personify it, do we? We freely talk about love. And we understand what we're talking about, and we have a sense that we experience it at times, and that it's missing at times, and we all that. But when we talk about evil, we tend, I think, to push it away from ourselves, and we do not buy in to the fact that we are also the enemy, that it is part of us, that not only a bureaucracy, that a bureaucracy only becomes an image for evil, but that it is very much moving in the world. Have you ever met a person where you just said, yes, there it was. There was evil personified. Have you ever had that happen to you? Scares the liver out of you. But I caution us that to be able to know that about one person does not mean that it all resides there. That would be a real convenient way to meet the problem of evil. It's very present in our lives. And what we saw in the Holocaust, especially if you see some of those films and stuff, you just can't, or you read the book, Night, you can't walk away from what that really looks like. Regular people. They appeared to be regular people in towns throughout a particular part of the world participating in this rank destruction of humankind. That's got to be evil. So the question of sin and evil is just lifted up to us. We want to talk a little, yeah, sure.
How do you contrast mental illness and sort of an evil behavior? I mean, some of the things we interpret as being evil may be a reflection of things that are internally wrong within those individuals.
I suppose that you can, it depends on how you think about evil when you take it with mental illness. That it is, in fact, mental illness is such a... it works so against life, and it is to be pitied, you know, it's a sad thing. And it is, in a sense, then evil, because it's against life. But we would be compassionate and understanding, yeah.
I just feel I need to say I work with a lot of mentally ill people, and most mentally ill people do not commit crimes against other people, and the proportion of mentally ill people that commit crimes, especially violent crimes, is at or below the level of people without mental illness. I just feel compelled.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you do. do you understand what I'm saying in terms of working against life, against a person within themselves? That it's, it. What is so sad is to watch, for example, someone who has depression fading away and watching that life disappear and not being able to stop it. And there's a sense of, there's something evil about this that I can't, that we can't restore this human being. We want this person to live. But I don't. But it's not evil in the sense of pejorative, negative. So maybe it's not a good word to use. No. As Wiesel worked through his writings, which are very interesting, and came to the present day, he came back to his faith because, you know, as a Jew, he understands something about God that a lot of us don't get. What are the Psalms?
Psalms of praise.
Sometimes.
Cries to God.
Yeah. How long, O Lord, is that from Isaiah or from Psalms?
Psalms.
Thank you. So they can be positive or negative, but they are cries to God. A Jew understands we're in dialogue with God. That's what it's about. That's what Job is about. And Brown kind of likes Jeremiah in this regard. And this is one of the reasons that I so respect Ellie, is because he's in constant dialogue with God. I mean, his whole life is a conversation. And I remember a theologian saying to me once, hold God accountable for the promises that God has made. We have that privilege. God, I don't like it the way it is right now. And I don't have to self-edit myself, self-censor when I feel that way. And then I can be in relationship with God. So in regard to the Holocaust, this surely must be what has to go on. This conversation with God that says, now wait, it doesn't make sense. A second thing that Wiesel would say is he doesn't want to understand. He doesn't want to understand the Holocaust because that would mean that there has to be some answer for all of this, that God had some plan for all of this, that somehow God was instrumental in making all of this and forming it into a nice, neat pattern. We, you know, Christians kind of hate that. I think there's part of me that leans to the Old Testament terrifically because Christians always want it all solved. A nice, neat answer. And aren't always real eager to look at all the contradictions.
Fred Nehner has done a good job. He did one session on talking about the, looking at the parts of the Bible that are unacceptable to us. Mm-hmm. And then talking about falsehood and cynicism as neither one answers the false. So, you know, the understanding maybe is the false hope, sort of saying somehow this makes sense.
This all would make sense, and there was a reason for it. And now we can look back and say, you see what we learned from this terrible experience? Well, sorry, Elie Wiesel cannot look back and say, what did I learn from this experience? It doesn't work. So, understanding may not be the goal. Wrestling with God, being in relationship with God, and raising the questions may be the goal that we have. And to do that in all parts of our life.
That's why I wonder why he says his faith died when he saw the flames.
It did.
But yet you find him wrestling with God the day before Rosh Hashanah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is that,
he's talking with God.
There is that arguing with God going on his faith as it was in God, but there was something there that recognized that God was still arguing with.
Mm-hmm. It's that whole thing about if God weren't there, I wouldn't be asking and being so angry and questioning.
If you say you can't understand this,
because this isn't part of God's plan, happen, then you're sort of saying, aren't you, that God's in as big a mess as we are. Things just sort of happen. And if somebody comes in here and machine guns us all, God can't control that. Isn't that what you're saying? God is powerless as a woman.
I think that what you're raising is exactly the dialectic that we will live with all our lives. If somebody comes in and machines guns down this whole room, is somebody going to say that was God's will? If they do, I'm likely, if I'm still alive, to choke them. Because that doesn't fit how I understand God. But then what do you do with the Holocaust? How do you come to understand God? Nasty? Capricious?
Powerless.
Powerless, exactly. And so that's where he comes up with, again, relationship. God is about relationship. And on those times when we can really let ourselves imagine meeting God sometimes, if you can think in those kinds of terms anymore, there will be some great questions to ask. But the relationship is what comes for Wiesel. And he maintains it faithfully. And then, as he moves through his stories, he also begins to be in relationship with human beings. And so some sort of forgiveness comes out of this thing. Understanding. Anger at Roosevelt, but understanding of human beings and our incapacity to be perfect. I better show that video, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's called Facing Hate. And I'll just see if we can get it on the... How many are leaving Saturday? Some, okay, yeah. We'll see if we can squeeze it in someplace so you can see it and hear him talk about it. In his stories, you know, one way to react to that kind of enormous degradation is to just stay away from people for the rest of your lives. Your trust is just broken with humanity. And he also works that through in one of the stories, you see. Can I dare trust to be in relationship with anybody after this? This is the problem of the abused as well, very often.
Could I just mention about Corrie Ten Boom and her family? What a tremendous thing, facing hate, and how Corrie Ten Boom's father even wore a Star of David, you know, to identify with the Jews, and how they faced picking in Jews and being sent off concentration camps, and a tremendous attitude just because God gave them the grace to see through what was happening. Mm-hmm. I think I was thinking when someone said, well, would I be able to stand up for what was right in that situation of Corrie Ten Boom's father when Corrie was going to go on the train. You probably heard that story.
You didn't tell the story.
You know, and her father, and she said that she was concerned she didn't have a ticket, and her father said, don't you know that just when you get on the train, I'll give you the ticket, meaning that we can't imagine what we would do in situations like this, facing hate. But by the grace of God, if we're walking with him, we can, you know, take one step at a time, as Corrie Ten Boom did, and react in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Wiesel would be very concerned that we not ever solve this with some easy answer, the Holocaust, nor forget it, nor dissociate ourselves from the pain, which is why the book is very good and helpful. And it's a book I think young people can read and benefit greatly from. Because that would be denial is part of what made that thing work. And we all slip into denial when we don't like the pain. Someone was just with me the other night and said that something had been going on in their town. It was a sex abuse kind of deal. Oh, she said, we just turn off the news when that comes on. And I thought, that isn't going to help the kids that are being abused here. The denial, because it causes us pain, this is kind of where we, this is where kind of Christianity comes through for us. And that is that we walk in the pain with people in relationship. Finally, Wiesel has come to the place where he's written things, where he's able to take Old Testament stories and or biblical stories and translate them into today. And so you can begin to look at Abraham and Isaac. And Isaac is a victim, isn't he? Just as the Holocaust people were. And how does God operate in that story? And then who is this Isaac, and how is he? How does he come drawn out of the story? Well, that's another subject. Do you have any other questions?
Can I get back to something with Luther and the ELCA? It seems like Luther said as much about the gypsies as he did the Jews.
Oh yeah, I'm sure he did.
But did they ever write a statement about the gypsies?
No, probably because we don't have, quote, gypsies in the United States. But if you were to go to Europe, I'm surprised at what people say about gypsies. I don't know how you would compare that here. Mm-hmm. But there's a definite bias against them.
A gypsy church in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, it is there?
I once had
so I don't know much about that. I see it. You're raised in the upper Midwest. It's cold half the year and you don't know what's going on.
I guess I would be concerned that they don't see the completeness of asking forgiveness.
Uh-huh, I see. I'm sure this has come because we live in relationship so much more with Jewish people, and a real sense of, that's good, I think you should drop them a note. Yeah, that's good. Other questions? Well, I'm sorry that we couldn't just take the book and go through it a page at a time, or a chapter at a time, and really pull it apart here. But I hope that if you haven't read it, that you will. And if you have, I'm sure that it's a book we don't forget.
Could I just ask if Wiesel had any contact with Christians who really stood up for the Jews and for their faith? I mean, such as Corrie ten Boom's family. I mean, just as military.
Since then, you mean? Oh, sure.
Yeah, and
sure.
Was he influenced by people who also? I haven't read any of his works, but I'd like to. But that there were Christians who, by the grace of God, didn't just go along with all this, you know, such as Bonhoeffer and others.
And he gives all kinds of credit to such people. And he's in relationship with that kind of person all over the world. He has become, in a sense, the symbol, I think, the person who represents that event in our history. And so he has many of those opportunities. And he certainly is grateful for and gives praise to, but always he sees as his responsibility. I said to him one day, you know, it is a privilege that you can tell us some of these things. And he said, it is such a responsibility.
It's what?
Such a responsibility. And he was tired that day. And he sees that his responsibility is to always make us know what happened. And that it was for him night, and for some people death.
And it is true that in our schools, sometimes they just kind of slide over that to the people who weren't living at that time or shortly after. Just kind of, well, you know, that's just, it maybe didn't even happen.
And it's our job to do other, to say otherwise.
I think it's standard to read Diary of Anne Frank, I think, at the eighth grade level. When I was teaching in an American school in Libya, the Diary of Anne Frank was cut out of all of our books.
I wonder what the German children are taught. I wonder what the German children are taught.
I would too.
It's just, that's a struggle there.
Well, we were discussing, we have a young Japanese woman who's married to a first-generation American, and his parents, he has on his family both Bosnians and Serbs. But anyway, he's an American, and we were asking her what she was taught in Japan about the Second World War. And most of the emphasis on was what a crime the A-bomb was. Mm-hmm.
That's a great example, and August 6th, I think, is the day that's set aside to remember our participation in that kind of, that literally is a Holocaust also.
Fire burning too.
Yeah. So I guess that's what I would take away from this most of all is we are all, what do we say in the confession? We confess that we are in bondage to sin. And we don't escape that. And we cannot free ourselves. That's what we're talking about here. We are in bondage to sin. We are part of the evil of the world. And if we can hold that in our mind, then we won't let something like this be neatly put into angels and nice things. And like, I'm into angels these days because I notice how nice they've all become and how cute and how popular and how easily we can just take that on and forget all about the other stuff.
I know, I really thought, I know that Jews believe in guardian angels, and I thought, couldn't he just have called on his guardian angel to, you know, but they were so innocent up to the end and kind of saying, you know, it won't happen, we don't need to flee to Jerusalem. And so we must have all been awfully naive. You know, I mean,
we
that
are
was 1944.
We're all naive.
Well, I remember the first time my father ordered, and I think it must have been after the war or near the end, well, certainly after the liberation of the camps, and my father ordered me to read this condensed thing in the Reader's Digest that really told all the details, and, but that was the first I ever heard about it.
But we continue to be so ignorant. I mean,
some people still deny it.
But I mean that... But it continues. If it's not in Germany, it's in...
East Timor. How many people know what has happened and it's happening in China and East Timor?
Exactly. It just keeps going from one part of the world to the next part of the world to the next part of the world. I mean, it's
supposed to be war. The question that we had up was, where was God?
Mm-hmm.
Where
is
we? Where are we?
Yeah. And where is God?
Where is God?
Exactly. Let's pray. Gracious God, the mysteries of life we do not understand. We understand only that we must lean on you, that we can be in dialogue.